Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. This is the podcast where we talk about politics, geopolitics, economics, and culture. It's an extension of my weekly newsletter, which is for subscribers to Reaction. To become a subscriber to that, go to www.reaction.life and sign up. On the podcast today, I'm delighted that the author and journalist Ed Conway is my latest guest. Ed is the economics editor at Sky News and author of the book Material World, a substantial story of our past and future. It's a gripping, endlessly fascinating investigation into how the modern world really works. From the extraction processes to treatment, through the vital supply chains and onto the consumer, Ed follows the stories of those key substances that have built the modern world: sand, salt, iron, copper, oil and lithium. Ed, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So how did this book come about? Why did you think it was important to reveal to us the processes behind all our essential substances?
I mean, I guess it's partly just because I've always, I'm kind of interested in parts of the economy and parts of the world that are perhaps underappreciated and underreported. And it struck me, I guess kind of almost in an abstract term, over a long period, that we just weren't paying enough attention to how the basics of how our world actually come about. So how do we make the stuff that we all depend on? I work as a journalist, as you mentioned. I'm kind of cover a lot of data stuff, a lot of economic stuff in my day job. And I guess I also kind of inhabit this world that feels quite kind of ethereal and dematerialized. I trade in ideas, and I give plausible answers to when people ask me questions about things. And I spend a lot of time with my head in spreadsheets. And I've always had this nagging feeling, I guess, that there was this whole other world of how you actually kind of get the materials that we depend on to make the computer I'm using work, to make the internet work. I had the sense that, you know, it wasn't just a dematerialized, ethereal existence that we live in, that we depend on more physical things. And I guess I had this kind of epiphany a few years ago. I went to visit this gold mine for a story which was not really about gold mining. It was actually about Brexit. But I found myself at this gold mine looking at this place. And essentially, in order to make gold these days, you destroy a mountain. You're destroying a landscape to do it. We're no longer kind of going down underground and kind of with a pickaxe chipping at a shiny vein of rock. Instead, you obliterate large parts of the landscape and you process them down into a kind of almost talcum powder consistency and then add some chemicals, and then you end up with a bar of gold. And in the case of gold, you kind of need to destroy an incredible amount of the landscape in order to get quite a small amount of gold, because the grades of gold are relatively low. And I found the experience quite striking. And the thing that came away with me after I left the gold mine was, well, hang on, you know, if that's what we're doing to get hold of this substance gold, that, you know, the vast majority of uses of gold are actually, you would probably term them discretionary. I mean, jewellery and monetary gold. So most of this stuff ends up either kind of used as a form of jewellery, or it ends up in a vault somewhere underneath London. And therefore, is it, you know, you could kind of like make the argument that, you know, we don't necessarily need gold, or at least most uses of gold, we don't really need it for the continuation of global civilization. And it struck me, if that's what we do in terms of, you know, tearing apart a mountain, which, by the way, turned out to be a kind of sacred mountain in this part of Nevada that I was at, if we tear down mountains to get gold, what do we do to get the stuff we really actually need? And what is the stuff we really actually need? And that kind of led me down this other wormhole of trying to understand, what are the materials that we all, the rest of us, the 80% of us that work in the services sector, those of us who kind of think we live in an ethereal, dematerialized existence, What is the stuff we actually need to make our jobs actually happen? And it struck me, well, you know, concrete must be there, because you don't really have cities or buildings without concrete. Steel must be there, kind of similar point. You don't really have infrastructure without steel. If we're going to make anything, you need steel to do it. Copper, you need copper wiring for electricity, and so on and so forth. And the funny thing was, there was no spreadsheet that I encountered that actually kind of gave me the answer of what these things might be. So I guess I had to kind of go down a slightly kind of journalistic route to talk to as many people as possible who work within kind of resources, mining, and in economics, to try to understand, what are those substances we need without which civilization wouldn't really happen? And that's kind of the starting point. But then it turns out, as is often the case, the journey was even more fascinating because all of this stuff interlinks, there's echoes throughout it. You get lots of stories, I guess, that haven't really been kind of much appreciated before. And then it kind of, by putting your staff down on that kind of, ground level perspective of the economy, you start to see things differently. And you also start to kind of get an appreciation of things like, carbon emissions and net zero and the challenges facing us in the future, which I found quite helpful. Like I now really understand net zero. I understand the energy transition in a way I never did before. And I think that's partly because I was began looking at it not from an abstract perspective, but looking at it from the perspective of, well, what is the stuff we need to make our lives actually kind of turn around?
You mentioned there that so many of us now in the modern economy work in the services sector, but do you think that it's the digital turn and the rise of technology is that what has severed most people's connection to the physical materials that power the modern world? I mean, maybe it's partly connected to the way in which the labour market has changed as well. Maybe 50 years ago, many more people would be members of trade unions. Certainly, in an economy like the UK, they'd be working in great industries like steel or coal or shipbuilding. Does the disappearance of that and the replacement with technology explain what's happened?
I think it's part of the answer. Yeah, part of the answer is that actually just to make a ton of steel, or for that matter, cement or copper or anything else, we've become so good at automating these processes that you need fewer and fewer people to do them. I mean, part of the reason there's far fewer people working in steel mills these days, partly it's because in countries like the UK, we're not producing as much steel. But actually, even more than that, it's because we have just become incredibly good at automating all of these processes. And that in a way is an amazing economic story. There's some big consequences for labor markets and for society, but it's also an extraordinary story because it means that we are able to make things with ever fewer people. But the consequence of that is there's ever fewer people working within these sectors who actually understand A, how to do it, and B, why they matter so much. So we don't spend much time thinking about chemicals, but without the chemicals sector, we're all dead, basically. We don't spend much time thinking about fertilizer because there's not many people who it takes these days to make a Haber-Bosch plant actually work. And yet, without that fertilizer, we're still not able to survive. So part of it is the fact that kind of just that labor market element. I think part of it is also, we in developed economies in particular have outsourced a lot of this to elsewhere. So we just, that stuff that we there's still stuff we're doing here, but for a lot of the stuff is just made in China, basically, or made in Eastern Europe, or made in other places in south of the border in North America. So I think that we are not doing it as much ourselves. I think it also was always beneath the radar, and these were often considered to be kind of low skilled jobs, even though actually a lot of this stuff is higher skilled jobs. And I think there was the conventional wisdom is that, there's a higher form of economic activity, which is services and which is brain power, which I understand. I mean, that's what I do myself. But in practice, you can't do any of the jobs that most of us do without having buildings to inhabit, without having an internet to be able to communicate on. And if you want the internet, you need fiber optics. And if you want fiber optics, you need to be able to make them for something. And basically, you're making them from glass, which is made from sand. And we still need to make this stuff. So I think that the other kind of side of it is we when we look at the economy, we look at statistics like GDP, and GDP is an amazing way of trying to get a sense of the aggregate activity in an economy. It's easy to moan about the problems with GDP because there are many, but it's still an amazing way a prism. But the problem with it is, it's or one of the problems is, a pound in GDP is still a pound or a dollar or whatever it is, and that pound, it might be generated by people paying or kind of earning money from Facebook. It might be generated by people making cement. It doesn't make any kind of distinction between the two of them, and that's fair enough because it's still a pound of value as we as society view it. But I would say that pound that goes into making cement is especially important because without cement, you don't have the server centers that you need in order to run Facebook. And there's a kind of notion of dependence that economics isn't very good at dealing with. We depend all of us, for our lives, for our survival, on actually a very small slice of economic activity that we just don't spend much time thinking about. And that slice of economic activity is kind of what the book is about. And I think these days that kind of matters not so much when you can just expect that people you're going to be able to buy cement or copper or steel or whatever it might be from the other side of the world pretty easily. But then suddenly, if you're in a situation, and COVID gave us a good example of this recently, where you have problems with supply chains, or you're in a situation where, God forbid, you're going to war with each other, then actually this matters, in an enormous way. And that's, I think, the thing is that even in the course of writing this book, I think we, which I kind of did, started like 3 or 4 years ago, even in the course of writing that book, the world has become a slightly scarier place. And therefore, when it's a scarier place and when you have threats to supply chains and threats to your ability to get one thing from the other side of the world, then actually you actually have to start thinking about this stuff all over again. And that's, I think, where we are now.
Well, precisely. And there's a political component as well, isn't there? You mentioned Port Talbot, which for listeners who are not in the UK is a blast steel blast furnace in the UK, which is closing down and is going to be replaced by modern furnaces, which require far fewer employees. And that makes me wonder about how politicians talk about what you've just been describing. Politicians make a lot of claims about how the economy is going to be transformed for net zero, but it's usually without basing it on the realities described in your book.
I think it usually is, well, I mean, it's usually the case that the understanding of this stuff is far more primitive than one might have expected, and I've been quite surprised at the extent to which some of the stuff in my book has come as a bit of a shock to policymakers. I've been invited in to talk to various government departments in the UK and actually elsewhere as well, because I just don't think they've been thinking in this mindset before. But they are starting to now. And I think part of the problem, particularly for us in the UK, to some extent in the US as well, is we had such bad experiences of what you might call industrial strategy back in the 1970s, and in particular in the UK, we backed a lot of companies that just didn't, go very well. That we are especially allergic to kind of just thinking in terms of, okay, you're a government, let's just try and understand how the world, the economy fits together. Even leaving aside the question of whether you're going to be intervening, I just think we have been very much of the mindset, and the 80s very much encouraged us to do this, that you just leave it to its own devices. There's a great essay that if any of your listeners have studied economics, they may remember by an American economist back in the 1950s called Leonard Reed, I Pencil, it was called. And the idea of this essay is just it's telling the story from the perspective of being of a pencil, about how the pencil came to be. And it's saying, I am a pencil. And here is the wood that goes into me. It comes from this forest on the other side of the world. Here is the lead, the graphite that comes from somewhere else entirely. Here is the metal. Here is that. And essentially, over the course of this quite short essay, which is very much worth reading, you learn how a pencil is made, and you learn that it is the part, it is the product of many hands. And the kind of the killer line in it is, even for this, the most kind of simple of all inventions, there is not a single human being who knows how to make me, because I'm the product of this complex market, this complex supply chain, where one person on one end of the supply chain, say making the wood, doesn't have any clue as to the other side of the supply chain. And there is no grand magician, Wizard of Oz character somewhere in the background who is saying, well, this is how you make a pencil, this is how you put it together. And when this essay came out, it was the 1950s. And the main message that most people took from it, understandably, was, central planning is doomed. And Milton Friedman, it was one of his favorite essays, because it underlined just how central planning, couldn't possibly even think about how to make a pencil. Therefore, how could it think about how to make other things? And the point was here that the Soviet Union and communist economies just were doomed in the future.
And
But I suppose.
the Soviet Union, I suppose, was trying the grand magician Wizard of Oz approach, and it was failing.
They were trying, and they were failing, and that it was is what later became very, you know, increasingly evident. But I think that, you know, there's another lesson from it, which is we're not very good at understanding, not necessarily intervening and trying to manage these things, but just understanding the nature of supply chains and the nature of how one thing gets put together with another. And our kind of we, I guess, took the message from this that we needed to be completely hands off, and the market would take care of things itself. And that often is the case. But some, then every so often you kind of run into these moments where the supply chain has malfunctioned in one way or another, and it leaves you suddenly short of something that's rather important. And you know, we had a good example of it in the UK not that long ago during COVID. There's a fertilizer plant up in the north of England, which shut down for a bit because it needed to down tools. And the consequence of this, amongst other things, was that suddenly that plant, it turned out, was making the majority of, as a byproduct, the majority of carbon dioxide that was used later for other products, like other kind of functions, like, for instance, you put it into stun guns if you're trying to slaughter pigs, or less prosaically, you're putting it into fizzy drinks and things like that. And all of a sudden, the closure of this fertilizer plant meant there was a threat of a complete kind of shortage of carbon dioxide in the UK. And when this happened, and it was kind of resolved in the end, but it was a big shock for the foodstuffs industry, you know. And all of a sudden, people in government, in number 10, I was talking to people who were there when this was discovered. They didn't have a clue about this. They didn't have a clue about the kind of, I guess, the frailty or the you know, precariousness of the various different supply chains in the UK. Didn't have a clue that one plant making one thing could shut down and suddenly you're short of another thing. And merely starting to think in terms of, okay, here are these complex supply chains. Here is what we, you know, we need to just try and understand them a bit better. That's something that we're only now kind of wising up to. But, you know, CO2 or indeed pencils is only the start of it. You know, you need to think about these things when it comes to batteries. You need to think about it when it comes to critical metals. You need to think about it when it comes to your healthcare systems. And I just don't think as policymakers, we in the West have done much thinking in those terms. In China, on the other hand, I think China has been thinking about this for a long time and in a far more engaged way than we in the G7. And that again is a challenge because, you know, coming for the energy transition in the future, there is a massive industrial opportunity here, aside from the big problems that we can talk about as well. There's a massive opportunity here. And that opportunity means the winners of this coming industrial revolution are being determined right now. Who can make batteries best? Who can make solar panels best? Who can make wind turbines best? Who can do the hydrogen the best? And right now, China is in the lead on almost all of those fronts. And that is because they've been thinking in terms of manufacturing, in terms of supply chains, in terms of minerals for many, many years. And it's only now that we in the West are starting to kind of get round to it.
So we'll come back to China and the geopolitical challenges, but you base the book around chapters for each essential substance, and you mentioned the iPencil. That famous essay was clearly an inspiration to you in terms of writing Material World, in terms of how to tell the story. But so you focus on sand, salt, iron, copper, oil, and lithium. Let's take each substance in turn. Sand. The book starts with that. How, explain to us how crucial is sand to our modern world?
Well, sand is perhaps, you know, it's actually the biggest of all of the sections because it encompasses three things really in my telling at least. And you could say more about sand. But you know, sand is by far and away the biggest thing that we mine by weight in the world. We mine extraordinary quantities of sand. Usually when you're looking, when people think of mining, they don't really think of sand. Partly that's because, you know, for boring reasons within the kind of the sectors that deal with extraction, mining is on one side because they're dealing with metals, and then aggregates and sand are on another side, and they're just different companies who conceive themselves as different businesses. So, you know, there's that. But the amount of sand we extract is extraordinary. In large part, that's because we take sand and we turn it into land. So we are building out new land in many parts of the world. The Dutch have been doing it for centuries and centuries, but now look at Singapore, it's expanding all the time. Look at much of Asia, look at Japan, they are laying down new sand. And we extract sand in order to build cities. We extract it in order to make cement and to make concrete. Concrete is in part made from sand and aggregates. And so part of the sand chapter is about essentially just how we build the world, and cement is one large part of it because, well, we kind of in place an extraordinary amount of cement every year to make the world. Cement is one of the most extraordinary, amazing, world-changing materials, which, by the way, the Romans used to be able to make, and then we lost the recipe of how to make cement for more than 1,000 years, and then only rediscovered it at the kind of early period of the Industrial Revolution, which is another theme, by the way, throughout the book. I mean, people think about the Industrial Revolution, and they think, oh, they think of kind of mills, cotton mills, and they maybe think of steel being manufactured. Actually, the amazing thing about that period is there was just so much going on, and one of those things was rediscovery of how to make cement. Slightly different recipe to the Roman version, but nonetheless, completely, completely world changing. We just wouldn't have this world that we inhabit without it. So cement is one part of it, but actually the very first bit of the book is about glass, and I kind of thought that glass manufacture was this chapter as a whole was going to be basically all about history, and there's some great kind of historical stories. I should tell you one of them, which I love, which is one of the kind of most under-told stories from the First World War, which is about the Great Glass Famine, which is how in 19, basically as the First World War was kind of approaching, Britain kind of realized they'd already declared war on Germany, but they realized that they were starting to run out of binoculars, and part of the reason for this was that 60% of UK binoculars came from Germany. And this was a big problem because this was the first great war that was fought with artillery that were able to fire further than you could see. So you needed binoculars or indeed bullets. You needed binoculars, you needed sniper scopes, purely in order to survive and in order to kill the enemy. It was incredibly important. We talk about kind of silicon warfare these days. Well, silicon warfare back in 1914 was about binoculars. And the shortage was so great that, appeals were launched. There were newspaper advertisements saying you need to donate as many pairs of binoculars as you possibly can so that our troops can go off to the trenches and have these binoculars, because people were going off. The boys were being sent off to the continent across the channel without binoculars, and they were being killed in extraordinary numbers because the Germans had amazing lenses, amazing optics, amazing sniper scopes that they could use to kill British troops. And so, the appeal was launched. The king and the queen donated 4 pairs each of, I think, opera glasses and field glasses. And so you can kind of imagine the troops going off with these gilt-edged glasses to the Western Front. And the strike, and it got so desperate, actually, this shortage that they called the glass famine, that by 1915, actually, spies or a spy was sent from the Ministry of Munitions in London across to Switzerland to meet with German counterparts to make a deal to buy binoculars off the Germans in order to kill the Germans with. And this
Wow.
actually happened. This was a real event. And actually, the Germans, even more extraordinarily, said yes in 1915. This is according, by the way, to the official records that you find in the National Archives, which I've been to. In those official records, it shows that the deal was done, and the Germans were willing to give the British binoculars with which the better with which to kill them, because the Germans were desperately short of rubber, and the Germans needed that rubber for their tires and their fan bounce belts. And the British, through their colonies in Asia, controlled basically all of the global rubber trade. And so you have this kind of crazy moment, which comes back to what we were talking about a second ago, where two items that were not considered especially valuable before, that the Germans assumed that they could always get a hold of rubber to ship it from the other side of the world pretty easily. The British assumed they could always get a hold of binoculars, they just buy it in from Germany. All of a sudden, when you're faced with a war, then you can't rely on those supply chains anymore. And the striking thing, actually, a couple of things from that was, so this trade happened, and the British got their binoculars, and the German got their rubber, although not in massive quantities, according to the accounts. What the really kind of game-changing thing is that in the following kind of couple of years, the British were able to restart. So they used to have quite a big glass manufacturing industry, and it started to wither after too many taxes were imposed on it. But they gradually managed to rebuild. Well, actually, I say gradually, it's very quickly rebuilt their industry, so that by the end of the war, the British were making more binoculars than they needed. They were able to give some to their allies. And to me, that's kind of quite encouraging because it shows that, obviously, in the event of a catastrophic kind of diplomatic moment, you are able to rebuild, to reindustrialize, and to rebuild these old industries that you had allowed to go to waste. And I think that's quite a helpful thing to know about these days, because right now, when you look at our imports, we are reliant in just the same way on other countries for things, well, mainly China, for things like rare earths, for things like solar panels, for things like batteries, to a greater extent than we were reliant on Germany back in 1914. So there are quite interesting kind of echoes throughout history. And I should say, that's glass. That's just one little bit of the glass chapter. But then there's the real thing I wanted to get to within sand is silicon chips, because no one up until this book, as far as I know, at least within a kind of a book, has been able to kind of describe that eye pencil phenomenon for silicon chips. So when you're holding your smartphone in your hand, where does the silicon actually come from? A lot of people might be able to tell you very wise things about the amazing fabrication plant where the transistors in that silicon chip were actually kind of imprinted onto the silicon. But where on earth, literally, where in earth does the silicon come from? And I spent a long time, I guess, researching, talking to people, trying to understand the journey of silicon from the quarry all the way through to your smartphone, and that is in there, and I kind of call it the world, the longest journey, because it's one of the most extraordinary journeys in the world. But again, the fact that a lot of this stuff just hadn't really been written about before was wonderful for me as a journalist, because I saw an opportunity there. But it's also kind of alarming because these things, the semiconductors, are incredibly important, and it turns out when you look at the supply chain of how you make them, there are so many different pinch points all along the way, which, when you look from a geostrategic perspective, are sometimes a little bit scary, because we're relying on small, single points of potential failure to get something that a kind of technology that is these days in everything, literally everything. Semiconductors are everywhere, and we need, I think, better to understand these things. And we're only now, I think, we are starting to try to map these supply chains, and the US is ahead of the UK on that, for instance, and Australia is quite far, but it's early days.
In terms of the UK government, whose responsibility is it? I mean, has a function developed at the centre where there's a team of people considering all this stuff and
I mean,
preparing a plan on
they're getting
resilience?
better. Yeah, they're getting better. It's the business department is the answer. So it's called DBT now, Department of Business and Trade. And they're getting better. And having had conversations with them, both in the course of writing this and also afterwards, they're more alive to it now. But they would admit, if you talk to officials there, that no, for a long, long time, we just didn't really bother thinking about this stuff. Not out of laziness, just because the assumption was
It's
that
just,
it would mostly take care of itself.
it was that was the fashion in the global economy, wasn't it? Or in large parts of across the West. It's understandable in that sense.
And it kind of predates the, people talk about like the Washington Consensus. I would say this predates it, I think it's not really for, well, maybe since the last war that people were kind of actively really thinking about the construction, the nature of supply chains, at least within developed economies. I think if you're China or to some extent India, you're thinking about this a bit more. But this is, it's new, but it's old. We're having to think about what industrial strategy actually comprises of for developed economy. Normally, when people think about industrial strategy in the past, it's often been about, okay, you've got to build an economy. You're a young economy that doesn't really have much of the way of industry. So you've got to protect certain different domestic trades, whether it's steel or shipbuilding or whatever it might be. on the way up, like South Korea has done. But now people in the US are asking themselves, well, okay, is this something that we need to think about more actively now? Because for all the, obvious reasons, we might be in a Cold War, we're racing for the same kind of materials all at the same time. But I think wherever you kind of come out on that, I actually just don't think there's any harm with just trying to just understand it,
I agree.
regardless of the extent to which you're trying to intervene. We should be understanding where fertilizer comes from, because that's one. If we don't have fertilizer, then pretty soon we're all dead. So that
Yeah.
could do with kind of being pushed up the order.
Maybe with it, in Britain's case, maybe it's also partly a legacy of empire, because globalization is not new, is it? There's that sort of first wave of globalization post the Industrial Revolution, and Britain's at the forefront of that. Just that belief that you could always get something from somewhere, and it was probably sitting on British territory, or you could barter it. And that Britain sat at the centre of a great network. And I suppose the war was then, you described it very well in terms of glass, and there are other examples as well. The war was a sort of wake-up call, and then post the wars. Then empire is replaced with markets and global markets. And again, the assumption just develops that you can always get the stuff if you need it. But maybe the world has changed. Just on the point of mining and extraction, I mean, you say in the book that for every car, building, or plane that's been manufactured, I think you describe it as a pile of rock 6 times its size has been blown or bulldozed out of the planet. Now, is this hugely intensive way of extracting commodities, is it sustainable, or are we getting better at it?
I mean, it's a really good question. The funny thing is actually, so the answer is we're getting better at it, but also consider something like copper. Okay, copper is really interesting because of all of the materials in the book, actually copper is probably the most scarce. But we've never really had a problem of running out of copper, and there have always been these kind of scares throughout history where people got terrified that we were going to run short. They were getting terrified back in the 1910s and 1920s when it was the first age of copper. And remember here, when we talk about copper, that's a shorthand for electricity. And it doesn't take an expert to realize that if you didn't have electricity, then everything is gone. Our entire civilization is gone. And that is all thanks to lots of copper wires that you never see, and they're behind the scenes, somewhere behind the kind of paneling in your home, and elsewhere. And these days we need crazy amounts of copper, because the logic for going to net zero is to electrify a lot of processes that were previously have been kind of combustion engines. And as a result of that, you need massive wires of copper in the grid. You need a go big kind of copper kind of wires as thick as your elbow going out to offshore wind turbines and so on. So we have got much better over time at mining copper. We will need to get much better in the future. But the upshot of getting better, in inverted commas, in this case, is that whereas previously what was considered a viable copper ore was something that was, I don't know, maybe kind of like 4 or 5% copper. So a piece of rock that has 4 or 5% copper in it. These days, the typical copper ore has less than 1% copper in it. And we've become incredibly good at shifting more and more rock and processing it with more, getting more and more copper out of it, but having to move ever greater piles of rock in the time being. So when you look at the amount of ore that we actually have to move, it's actually got bigger and bigger over time, just because we've got the easy stuff. We've already got the easy stuff, whether it's copper or whether it's iron. And that's part of the reason why the amount of rock we shift every year has gone up and up. It's partly that the ore, the waste rock, is a kind of bigger proportion of that. Partly it's because you've got a growing population. This is a large part of it. So when you look at the amount of steel or iron, steel or concrete that's moved shifted around the world, a lot of that has happened in China, and a lot of that has been to satisfy a massively urbanizing population. But the same thing will happen with India, or is it's happening with India. India is an extraordinary story right now of growth in all of this stuff, whether it's concrete or iron. And the same thing in due course will happen with Nigeria and Pakistan and other countries where the population is growing much faster than in China. So there is, I just don't see much prospect of those charts. So like one of the things that struck me, as someone who likes charts is when you look at the charts of how much stuff we get out of the ground, and this includes things like sand, it's not just your metals, it includes fossil fuels as well. Those don't show much sign of let up, and they look a lot like the charts that you probably remember from COVID, where they're exponential charts. They're just going up and up and up in this kind of ever increasing curve. Now, at some point, they'll start to kind of plateau. I just don't think they're going to start to plateau as quickly as some people are assuming. There's some people out there who say, "Well, it's going to plateau pretty soon because we're going to stop mining coal and we're going to stop mining oil and all of these things." Well, yeah, we might slow our kind of growth in extracting oil. We might slow our growth in extracting gas a little bit, but they'll still be growing for quite a long time, certainly towards the end of this decade. And coal, every single year, the forecast has been that coal is about to peak, and every single year it has not peaked. And at some point, yes, it might well peak, but it hasn't happened yet.
What is
And
it?
so human demand for stuff seems to be pretty kind of
Yeah,
reliable.
not going to disappear. What would happen if we did stop? I mean, there are campaigners who say, look, this is completely unsustainable. Look at the ecological damage that's being done. You have to stop. What does the world look like if I don't think it is going to happen, because I don't think populations
Do you
would
mean
vote
fossil
for it.
fuels or everything else?
Everything else. If there are campaigners, some of them pretty mainstream, who say it's not just fossil fuels. There's all sorts of other stuff and other damage that we're doing. Not my view at all. So we must stop. What would the world look like within 5 or 10 years of such a decision?
I mean, I could completely sympathize with that view, 'cause as someone who's, gone to mines and spent quite a lot of time in these places, they're dirty places. I went to the one of the world's biggest copper mines, a place called Chuquicamata. It's been going since for more than 100 years. It is a hole.
There's this great description in the book of it. I think you describe it as longer and wider than New York Central Park, and as deep as the tallest building in the world is tall.
You could throw the Burj Khalifa in there and then it would disappear. You wouldn't know where it was. And it's like a canyon. And we made that. We humans made that. And the waste pile from this place. So, when you're building a mine, or when you're digging a mine, you process a lot of rock, okay? And some of the stuff is just waste rock, and you're not going to process it because it's kind of low ore. You throw that and you put that into mounds. They call them in Chile, they call them tortas, like a cake. You kind of pile them in a big mound near the mine because who cares? You're not going to use it. And the mounds, by the way, at this mine have become so big that they have now engulfed the local town. They've had to abandon the local town completely. Like a big town, it used to have Latin America's most advanced hospital. That is now under rock because they couldn't find anywhere else to put the rock. So you've got the rock that gets thrown away. But then even more scary is the toxic waste, which comes from the processing of the ores. That's known as tailings. And those tailings dams, so they basically put them into the behind these big earthworks, and they are part liquid, part solid. The dam for that particular mine is bigger than Manhattan, just the toxic waste. So I can totally understand why a lot of people look at this and they say, "This is disgusting, it's awful." But here's a useful way of thinking about that. It's both a conundrum, but it's a really good illustration. So we all, okay, here in the West, in Europe and in the US, we have quite a lot of steel in our lives. And you don't really think about the steel in your life because it's mostly kind of under wraps. It's the frame of the building you occupy, it's the chassis of your car. But the average person here has about 15 tons of steel per capita. Varies, from country to country, slightly more in others, but it's kind of around that 10 to 15 tons per capita. And if you think about it, what is that? Well, you've got about a ton of steel in your car, for instance, well, especially if you have an SUV. You've got steel in your house. You've got steel in the public transport system. There's steel in the rails of the trains that you're taking to work. You've got steel in hospitals. There's steel in schools. Steel is actually quite a good shorthand for development, for living standards, we are in a pretty good place in this country because we've got quite a lot of steel. And if you then compare our 15 tons of steel per capita to places like middle-income economies, they've got maybe 5 tons of steel per capita. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, it's less than 1 ton of steel per capita. Actually, in some places, it's kind of less than 0.1 tons. Now, those are places where you don't have cars, you don't have hospitals, you don't have enough schools. They want steel. And there is a massive, massive inequality. And I think that as a prism is actually probably sometimes better than thinking of GDP per capita, because that's giving you a sense of what we have. We have this stuff here. Now, we in this country are actually the encouraging thing is actually we've been plateaued at 15 tons or so of steel for quite a long time. There is, it kind of looks like once you get to a certain level, you're kind of okay because you can recycle steel pretty well. That's those furnaces we talked about back in Port Talbot. They're for recycling steel. So you can recycle most of the steel that you have, and you could stick with your 15 tons or so per capita. And it's I find that one of the most cheering things that I've discovered, which is like there might well be a point where people say, okay, that's kind of enough, and you just then go to almost a steady state. You still need a bit of virgin steel, but you can recycle most of the rest. However, what about those people who don't have the cars, the public transportation systems, the hospitals, the schools, all of those trappings that you need steel to make? And you do need steel to make them. You know, you can make pretty decent buildings with cross-laminated timber, but you actually still need steel in a lot of them. And they're not very big, and they're actually a lot more expensive. So what about people in sub-Saharan Africa? Are we going to say to them, well, we don't like this mining, so you can't have more of the steel? Or because obviously you talk to people there, or you talk to people in India, and they are kind of almost can't quite believe that people would be laying down rules and restraints that would be constraining them from building the infrastructure they need to improve their standard of living, to improve their life expectancy, because that's kind of what this amounts to. We are able to live long lives in part because we have steel in the hospitals, in the machinery, in all of the things keeping us alive. So, who are we in the West to say to other people elsewhere that you can't have that living standard, that you can't aspire to the living standards that we have? I think that's like a really fundamental question we need to ask ourselves. And it's very fundamental when you think about what it takes to make steel, because there is still no way of mass manufacturing steel these days, virgin steel, which is what you need here. We can't just recycle steel in this case, because you need more steel for the cars, well, not necessarily cars, but all of the bits and pieces like the hospitals that you're going to need in sub-Saharan Africa. Who are we to say that you can't make that? And there is no way of mass producing it without a lot of carbon emissions, because we still haven't cracked it. We still haven't worked out the technology to make steel in large quantities without big carbon emissions. And the only ways we have of doing it are really, really, really expensive. And so we're kind of facing this dilemma, I think, which is that if we're going to get to net zero across the world, which is kind of what matters, we have a bit of a crunch. You know, either people will be must be, you know, allowed to make the steel that gives them the living standards they expect, in whatever way they can afford, which is to say in blast furnaces, and it's going to be very carbon intensive, or we in the West, who care about this stuff much more, we'll have to find a way of financing them to ensure that they can do it in a green way, which would be very expensive, trillions and trillions and trillions of pounds and dollars. And I think there is no, as far as I can see, COP is nowhere near being able to resolve this yet. But to me, this is one of the big kind of crises of diplomacy that's coming up in the future. Talk to people in India, in Indian government, as I have. And they see rank hypocrisy here, with the West essentially laying down rules that will give it a kind of moat with all of its steel and all of its contraptions that it can happily recycle, and the rest of the world with nothing. And we need somehow to reconcile this. And I think until we kind of understand the realities of it, which means thinking in terms of, look, here's how much steel we have per capita, then we're just not going to get there. And I think we're going to have some enormous bumps in the road. But yeah, the good news is when you get to a certain level, then it might well be that we kind of have enough. Although, footnote, there are quite a lot of examples, something called the Jevons paradox, which I don't need to go into in depth. There's quite a lot of examples of how when we think we're really good at improving the efficiency of certain processes, we actually just use that efficiency to make more things. There is a quite a, it does seem like there's a human instinct to just kind of make more stuff. So I, there is a bit of hope, but there's plenty to be concerned about as well.
I'm assuming that the Jevons paradox is that William Jevons, the economist?
Yeah, William Stanley Jevons, and the idea, he basically wrote this piece, a book, I think The Coal Question it was called, back in the 18, I don't know, 50s, 60s, saying, hang on, steam engines are getting better, so they're more efficient, but we're not burning less coal, we're burning more coal. We're finding ever more things to do with coal. And that's kind of the story at pretty much every technology. We make it more efficient, but then we eat up not all necessarily of the efficiency gains, but like some of the efficiency gains get eaten up. And then as a result of that, suddenly you're just making consuming more stuff and burning more stuff and mining more stuff. And that's another thing that we have yet to, I mean, these are not surprises, by the way. A lot of people within environmental economics that are well aware of what they call rebound effects, the Jevons paradox, and it's not a reason not to do anything. I think it doesn't mean you shouldn't be trying to kind of achieve the goals if you think they are kind of doable. It just means that getting to them is harder, and we need to have our eyes open to that. Otherwise, we are going to hit these moments where I think where people are going to be very surprised and they're going to realize, hang on, this is much more expensive than anyone told us it was going to be. It's much more difficult than anyone told us it was going to be. Why was no one honest with us? And I think that's the issue.
That's precisely what I was going to ask in relation to net zero. Do you think that there is a naivety in the way that we tend to in the West talk about this? Because it is, it seems to me, it's going to take longer than people think. We'll be undertaking quite a lot of these processes for longer than it's fashionable to admit in politics and in contemporary politics. But also, there's a sort of naivety about how we talk about these processes, which are described in your book. If something is perceived to be net zero or clean energy, that doesn't mean that it is devoid of extraction and drilling. I mean, it still requires, you've talked about copper, all sorts of other processes are required to make wind turbines, to upgrade the national grid, all of the sort of systems which are required across Europe, across the West. So they have the badge of being clean, and it may well be that we get there to cleaner energy later in the century. But am I right, or too cynical, about this, that I think some of the dates which are talked about by politicians are simply unrealistic?
I think on that last point, definitely the it's astoundingly ambitious. I don't, like when you look at the kind of what it would take to fulfill like globally the net zero, it's going to be very, 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 very difficult. And I don't think right now when you talk about people within the climate community, most people are like, well, 1.5 degrees is gone. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when we kind of admit that we're not going to be able to keep it below 1.5 degrees, and how we actually manage that. Because again, we've been making big pledges about it, and if it fails, then does that mean that people assume the whole thing has failed? But see, I would say on the flip side, while 1.5 degrees looks kind of quite unlikely, very unlikely, frankly, the risk on the other side also looks unlikely. So whereas a few years ago it looked like maybe we were heading towards 3.5 or even 4 degrees warming, now the kind of where we are heading pathway is maybe 2.5 degrees. And that is an enormous improvement that has happened largely because of technology. It's happened largely because there have been many more deployments of wind turbines, many more deployments of batteries and solar panels. And partly, by the way, that's thanks to China, who's been turning out this stuff, partly with coal, it should be said, but they've been turning out this stuff far faster than anyone expected. So, but to go back to a question, it's definitely true that in order to get to net zero, you have to do some dirty stuff. You have to do lots more mining. You have to do lots more digging. I kind of tend to think, listen, there is an argument for this, and I think it is a cogent argument, which is that rather than kind of mining stuff to burn, like fossil fuels, you're mining it to burn. In this case, you're mining copper to turn into bits of infrastructure which can be recycled in the future. So this it is to my mind a more sustainable way of doing it. And I do think that, in the life cycle, okay, so when you're making a solar panel, the thing that I like to point out, just because it's ironic, I guess, is to make metallurgical silicon, which is what you need to make solar panels. Same thing, by the way, as semiconductors. So that's the whole point of that chapter about the journey, the longest journey. You need to take that quartz out of the ground and put it into a furnace, and you burn it at really high temperatures alongside coal. So in order to make solar panels, you need to smelt metals, smelt ore with coal. And we have yet, and that's an old process that goes back more than 100 years, and we've yet to come up with a way of doing it without using coal. So to make this very cleanest thing in the world, you need to use coal. However, the life cycle emissions of a solar panel are far, far lower, obviously, than the life cycle emissions of a coal-fired power station or even a gas-fired power station. So these things do even out in carbon terms. But I do think there's a risk that by being so focused on the carbon footprint of something, you can kind of forget that there's another footprint, and that footprint is geological. And that footprint is also social, because you need to go into new areas with people. In my chapter about lithium, I talk about these places that we're mining for lithium, where there's lots of indigenous communities who are outraged about the destruction that's being wreaked on their landscapes. And the same, you could say the same thing about pretty much everything. It's rare to find a mine that doesn't tread in some way over someone, what they consider to be their indigenous rights. There's a whole chapter in the book in the iron section about a mine which obliterated this extraordinary set of caves that date back 46,000 years to, the last ice age, or before the last ice age, where we got human habitation going all the way back that period. So there's other forms of destruction, and also other footprints like water. The water footprint of this stuff is extraordinary for mining and for making a lot of this stuff. But I do tend to think that, there is this kind of promised land potentially in the future where we can have more sustainable electricity because we're not having to rely on getting oil from dodgy places. You're getting it from the North Sea, from wind turbines, and potentially more plentiful sources of power because, if we're building out this stuff, then why not build more of it? But getting there, I just think will be much more difficult than anyone appreciated. And when people signed up, when Theresa May in her final days in Downing Street signed into law, getting to net zero, it was 2019. There was no one in Downing Street who had the foggiest of what it really, really involved. It was just not really thought about as seriously as it could have been. And maybe that's just the way it has to be. Maybe you set a target and then people try and kind of get to it later on. But the getting to it will be very, very hard. It will be probably much more expensive than people appreciate. It will take a lot more work than people appreciate. But I suppose that the thing I just set against that, and by the way, we're having to try and do this energy transition faster than any energy transition we've done in history. Oh, and also we're shifting from kind of high density energy fuels to low energy density kind of set the sources of power. So there's a lot of reasons why it's kind
And
of
it's also,
like a bit terrifying.
I think you mentioned the cost there. I think I'm right in saying that the then Chancellor, Philip Hammond, estimated, and it may even have been more than £1 trillion,
It was
estimated
a
the cost
trillion
of
pounds, he said, but
£1 trillion. And that's almost half of annual UK GDP.
I mean, fathoming the cost is really hard, but it's like, it'd be very hard to imagine it wouldn't cost quite a lot, at least in the kind of short run. I think there's this kind of promise of, like, in the longer run, then you potentially have cheaper power. But in the short run, until you get over that hump, you've got more expensive power. And where does that hump fall? So where do things start to get cheaper? That's kind of not until like towards the end of this century. In other words, you and I, probably won't experience it. It's like it's generations of investment to get towards that promised land. And there are very few episodes of generations foregoing their standard of living in order that the future standard of living might be better. There's very few examples of that throughout history. But I do think, okay, the thing I set against all of that is to say that we've set ourselves this incredibly challenging task. Again, this is where I guess I think more as kind of from an economic prism, because the book is kind of like it's a bit about geology and material sciences and net zero, but I guess I'm coming at it as someone who thinks in economic terms. We in the West have moaned for years and years about being stuck in secular stagnation. We've got this productivity malaise we've been suffering from for years and years and years, but here we have just set ourselves a challenge that involves essentially having to rethink a lot of processes that haven't really been rethought for hundreds of years, stuff that we only really came up with at the Industrial Revolution, how to make cement, how to make certain chemicals. A lot of those processes are really carbon intensive. We are having to rethink all of this stuff all over again. And it's hard to think of another challenge and set of challenges, because it's a whole complex of challenges, that could yield as much productivity, all else equal, as what we are kind of setting ourselves to do. Now, yes, there's such an enormous set of things to kind of set against that, like the energy costs, and I don't dispute that. But I do say that this could be quite an exciting period to be living in, because we're having to rethink everything. And the fact that it hasn't been it didn't really occur to people when they were signing up to net zero, that's the big thing we can talk about. But we are where we are, and this set of challenges is extraordinary. And if you look in the US, where they have the Inflation Reduction Act, if you look at the amount of investment going into factories right now, it's crazy. It's enormous. If you look at the number of patents being kind of put into law in China about things like cement and things like new types of steel, it's amazing. So it's kind of quite an exciting, exhilarating period. And I don't dispute the difficulties, but I see this in I sometimes feel very pessimistic about it, and I sometimes feel quite excited and optimistic about it, because we are trying to do new stuff in a way that we haven't really done for quite a few decades.
On the plus side, of course, what you describe is also going to be supplemented by, well, artificial intelligence. A lot of concerns about that,
Yes.
but it is going to bring some positives for the economy. Quantum
Yes.
computing, just the speed of computing that's going to that's going to have a dramatic effect over the next 20, 30 years. Simultaneously, major advances in biosciences and medicine, which are going to bring about improvements in living standards and potentially life expectancy and quality of life. So all of that's positive. I mean, on the downside, you mentioned the energy costs, but can politics bear that really? If you look at what's happened to British energy costs and the energy cost or electricity costs as an input for industry, I mean, on one level, it's not surprising when you look at what's happened in the last 20 years that we're struggling to grow.
Yeah, I think there's going to be lots of bumps in the road. We're starting to see them in the UK, with kind of people revolting against the low emission zone that's just been implemented in London. There was a by-election that was kind of that was kind of very decisively kind of found against that recently. So I think that's just the start of quite a lot of revulsion from people when they realise that they're having to pay more for something that is incredibly important, energy. We forgot, I think, up until Ukraine, in this country at least, we forgot that energy is not just something that goes onto heating bills, but it certainly goes onto that, but it's everywhere. And when we had the cost of living crisis that we've seen, kind of across the world, it's a reflection of higher energy costs. Energy is 40% of everything. Just the energy inputs are 40% of the cost of everything. And so, and if you're trying to kind of go to a situation where you're getting your energy from less energy dense sources like renewables, if you're trying to kind of, invest in a massive new set of infrastructures that's going to be greener, then it would be, balmy to think that it was going to be free or cheaper. It's not going to be. It's going to be more expensive. There's just no, it already is more expensive when you look at the cost of energy. And I think part of the issue here is that this is not to say it doesn't get cheaper in the future, and it's not to say we shouldn't do it. I'm I guess a kind of believer in that, like it or not. But I do think that by pretending that it's cost free, we're gonna, that's setting people up to be really, really upset in the coming years, because it's not cost free. It is more expensive. Renewables have pushed up the cost of electricity in the UK. They have. It's just done in various kind of complex ways that's quite hard to get your head around. And also, by the way, there's this idea that and you hear it everywhere, that people say, oh, look, well, solar's cheaper now than coal or than gas, because there are certain prisms you can look through where it does look like solar power is cheaper than gas or other fossil fuels. However, when you adjust for the fact that actually that solar isn't there all the time, solar power is not there all the time, when you adjust for the fact that you need to find some sort of backup for it, when you adjust for the fact that you need to build a whole new electricity grid, then suddenly it's not cheaper. Suddenly coal is cheaper. And I don't, in just the same way, I think that people resented during Brexit being told that by supporting Brexit, they were in some way stupid, which I think was the implication, the insinuation during a lot of that campaign. I just fear that there's a similar thing here where people, reasonably, I think, say, well, hang on, this looks like it's getting making my cost of living more expensive. They are, to some extent, being lectured by people in positions of power saying, well, no, actually, look, it's cheaper. But that's wrong. And, I can understand why people are saying that, because they don't want people to feel upset about
Yeah,
it.
and then also,
But
it also if you then challenge that and you're told, well, okay, maybe it is a bit more expensive, but it's only a bit more expensive because we haven't done enough of the net zero stuff. So you have to do more of the thing which is making it more expensive for you. And people are not idiots; they can sort of follow, the logic of that and feel insulted.
And I think there's a recipe for alienation there, and that's and so I do worry about the kind of the backlash to net zero kind of getting worse in the coming years before, and who knows where that ends up. And like I say, that's just the domestic thing. Then you've got to think about the kind of what we were talking about earlier with other countries, developing economies being kind of massively deluded as well, with being lectured by the West.
Well, this was
So there's quite a lot of that.
going to be my final question, really, on the geopolitics of the situation. You just led perfectly into that, because we're living, you could say, almost in a war era, an era of potential conflict. Hopefully the wars won't spread, there won't be escalation, but Northern European security seems to be in medium term and long term jeopardy. Situation in the Middle East, which obviously has an energy component as well, and then there's Asia. Having finished this remarkable book, what's your conclusion about that geopolitical future and how the substances and production that you describe are going to play into it?
I think that it's, all of this stuff, the material world, everything kind of will come back to it. It comes back to energy, and obviously you've talked to Helen Thomson. Those themes never went away. We just forgot that they were there, and it plays more widely to the materials. And I think the kind of the even broader point is that supply chains matter. They never stop mattering. Where you get stuff from never stop mattering. In a world that looks kind of unsteady like it is at the moment, I think we need to do better at understanding how they're put together. And our understanding of them is incredibly primitive. I just think that even now, I was talking to people in one of the world's leading technology companies recently, who would be, if there was anyone who would understand whether companies have begun to kind of get a handle on their supply chains. Where does this come from? When you're thinking about the pencil, where do the bits and pieces of the pencil or the silicon chip actually come from? Even just this was a few weeks ago, they said even now, even after all of the shocks and scares that we've had recently about people thinking about what part of my supply chain comes from China, what part of it has this emissions, what part of it is at risk if there's going to be something else happening in the Red Sea, they still don't really get it. There is still no map of how this stuff fits together. And when you look at any statistic of global trade, that is such a primitive rendering of the deep complexities of how any single product you touch today is almost certainly a complex of components that come from all over the world. And therefore, if there were to be, sanctions or a war, especially with China, then the implications would be utterly enormous, way, way beyond what we've seen with Russia and Ukraine. And so that worries me. I mean, let me give you just one kind of final example on this. This is not actually something that was in the book, but it happened actually while I was filming something for Sky News. I went to visit this factory in Birmingham, making a piece about something else entirely. They had a machine that was pressing. It's a factory called a company called Brandauer, and they make nibs. They used to make nibs actually for like fountain pens. So they're very good at pressing very thin bits of metal at incredibly accurate proportions. And one of the things, they don't make fountain pen nibs anymore, by the way, but one of the things they were making was this little electrode, just a little piece of metal. And they said this, I said, what's that for? And they said, well, this goes in your rear view mirror of your car. And it's the bits, it's part of the electronics that helps it dim, the auto dimming, so you don't get glare when people kind of flash their headlights behind you. So it's an incredibly tiny bit of an incredibly tiny bit of a car that no one ever spends much time thinking about. And I said to them, so how many of these things are you turning out? And they said, we're turning out hundreds of millions. In fact, more than 50% of all the rear view mirrors in the world have our little bit, our little electrode in them. And I find that gobsmacking, as an example of a little invisible bit of globalization, of global trade that no one ever spends much time thinking about. These electrodes are then shipped off, I think, to China. And then they go inside into a factory who's making the rearview mirrors, who make the rearview mirrors, and they send them back to BMW or whoever it is in Europe. And then that's your rearview mirror, and it goes in there. No one, even within the kind of car companies, is thinking about that little bit of metal. And yet, that is one of, I guess it's hundreds of thousands, who knows, maybe even millions of little tiny components sitting, flying around the world on any given moment, that are a part of the complex of products we use every day. And I think that this era of, you mentioned the previous era of globalization, this era of globalization is of orders of magnitude more complex than what we've had before. Supply chains are way, way more complicated than they were in the past. And our understanding of them has not increased in terms of its complexity. It's still enormously primitive. Our statistics about this are primitive. Our visions of this are primitive. Our kind of models, our maps of it are primitive. And we need desperately to start thinking about that stuff. I think China thinks about that more than the UK or the US does. The US is starting to think about that a bit more with the recent kind of semiconductor crisis. But we really desperately need to kind of get a handle on this, because otherwise someone will do something stupid, and we'll be, before you know it, we'll be in the middle of a war. And we'll have another issue like we did with binoculars back in the First World War. And that to me is quite scary.
Ed, well, you've certainly made us think about it today, and I feel as though we've only scratched the surface of this
Actually,
remarkable
yeah, we never,
book.
I never got to talk about the salt or
Salt,
iron or copper,
or iron. We did a bit of
lithium.
copper, but yeah, there's so much another time. But we've been talking to Ed Conway about his book, which I highly recommend, Material World, A Substantial Story of Our Past and Future. Ed Conway, thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to The Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. To receive my weekly subscriber newsletter every weekend, go to www.reaction.life. Until next time, thank you for listening.